plywood, blacksmith, wheel rod, horse shoes. In a room at the back of the shop was a single cylinder, horizontal, 8-horsepower gasoline engine with large, heavy flywheels, which furnished power for a mill used to grind corn for cornmeal. Payment was made in kind or in cash for grinding grain. The main road passed in front of the shop. One day in 1908 at Shide, a huge steam tractor came down the road drawing behind it what was called a thrasher or separator, which was used to separate grain from the straw or stalk on which the grain grew. Different screens were used for wheat, barley, and oats. The old steam tractor whistle was blown at intervals to alert people who were driving and using horses or mules so they could control the animals which were scared of the engine. My younger brother Martin and I watched the tractor approaching. It was exciting, and we were, as other kids now, venturesome. We ran and climbed on the drawbar of the thrasher. The engineer had to look off temporarily to cross a ditch. At the same time, we dismounted from our perch. Martin fell under the iron wheel of the separator and was crushed in his chest before the engineer could stop the machine. The nearest doctor available was at Hamilton, 12 miles away. He had a span of dark belly of horses that were beauties, and a buggy. When he was notified to come to Shire, he drove the horses unmercifully. I was standing near the hitch rail in front of our house when he arrived. He leaped out of the buggy with his pill bag and rushed in the house, while other men cared for his team. The sweat on the horses had turned to lather for several minutes. The lather continued to drop off onto the ground in great splashes. Martin died, and in the adjacent room, Mama was lying in bed with her 2-day-old baby. In those days, babies were born at home, and the mothers were not permitted to get out of bed before 8 days elapsed. More than 300 miles away, Dad had relatives living in Dilly. About a year after the death of Martin, the distant domicile relatives came visiting. They drove in after nearly 3 weeks on the road with 2 covered wagons, 4 boys, each mounted on his own donkey, rode along with the wagon. The 2 families from Dilly visited with our family only a few days, then we loaded up all 3 families and visited relatives in Clarette. From there, with another covered wagon and 2 more families, we went to the Colorado River. When we arrived at a swimming stream, the adults tied the wagon beds, or boxes, to the running gear with ropes so they would not float away. Also, the cracks and seams in the wagon beds were chinked with rags. I rode behind a boy on his donkey. Many in the group could not swim, and I was one of them. The 3 covered wagons and 4 saddle donkeys shoved off across the stream, which was more than 200 feet wide. Immediately the wagons began to float, and all the animals, mules, horses, and donkeys, began to swim. The wagons tended to drift down the stream with the current, but the horses and mules were able to reach the other side in spite of the current. Women and kids were scared. Some were crying, some were having fun. Horse shearing was done, some horses were docile and were easily shod. Some even became accustomed to being shod and seemed to enjoy it. But not all the horses were gentle. They had to use different methods to control the fractious horses. Their nose twister was made of a heavy stick, usually a wagon wheel spoke. Through one end, a hole was bored, a loop of rope just big enough to pass easily over the horse's upper lip was passed through the bored hole in the stick, and to form a complete loop, the ends of the rope were tied together. when the horse became fractious, the loop was passed over his upper lip, and when the stick was turned or twisted, the loop tightened on the horse's lip. Very few horses would continue to rear up, paw or kick, when that nose twister began to hurt. The wild ones, the mean ones, sometimes had to be thrown and tied before they could be shod. Horses used on hard earth or rocks need iron shoes on their hooves, or else they soon became lame. The shoes were attached to the hoof with tapering flat nails driven through the edge of the hoof and clenched. About an inch of the nail stuck through the side of the hoof before clenching. The legs of the horse was held between the legs of the men while shearing. The horse sometimes jerked his foot and often caused the sharp nail ends to tear into the flesh of the man's legs. A wheelwright was a person who made or repaired wheels. Wagons and buggies often needed wheels repaired. Oftentimes, there were runaway horses that wrecked the vehicle that pulled. Age also caused the iron rim or tire to become loose on the wheel fetting. The rim had to be shrunk in order to make it fit snugly on the wheel. Formerly, the tire was heated red hot, then a short section was cut out, after which the two ends were welded together, thus making a smaller rim. Later, a machine with clamps for holding the rim, gears, and a long lever for shrinking the red hot portion of the rim eliminated the removal of the portion that was cut out. The perimeter length of the rim was thus shortened so it would fit snugly on the wheel. In replacing the rim on the wheel, the whole rim had to be heated, but not red hot, but hot enough to cause the rim to expand in length. While it was hot and expanded, it was placed over the perimeter of the wheel and cooled immediately with water in a slack tub, which caused the rim to tighten on the wheel. The two-room schoolhouse in our town in Shire in 1907 had a partition that could be adjusted to form one larger room. The first picture shows consisted of a metal box with an intense light fueled with coal oil and a reflector and a glass to magnify still pictures on a screen. It was called a magic lantern. It was very interesting to people of that era to see pictures enlarged on screen in such a way. Then came the movie as early as 1908. Although it jerked and fluttered and flicked, causing the actors to make jerking eccentric motions, to us it was tense and nerve-wracking when Jesse James was shot in the back by one of his own gang members, as portrayed in the picture. It rained a lot in 1919 and 1920 in North Central oil fields. Pavement was almost unknown. Roads became long stretches of mud and slush. At Ranger, Texas, in an important street, a horse hitched with five other horses fell down in the muddy slop. The harness had to be removed before the horse could get up so he would not drown. It was not unusual to find at the corners of the intersections of the main streets in town people with mud sleds or slides with two horses hitched to it, hauling people across the street in the slush, charging 25 and 50 cents for going across the street on the sled to keep out of the mud. From Ranger to Caddo, it was 20 miles. All field supplies were moved to Caddo by any means possible. Four horses could barely draw an empty wagon. They could, with four horses, move a very light load, about 1,200 pounds or something less. A man in 1920 came out of the hills near Graham with six oxen and an eight-wheeled wagon. He loaded a boiler that weighed about 12,000 pounds, oil field boiler at Ranger, and hauled it to Caddo, where four horses could barely pull a walking beam on a wagon. When he came across the bridge on Caddo Creek, he was spotted by some of the townspeople. He stopped his rig about 300 yards past the bridge near the center of the town. The steers laid down and chewed their cuds and rested. Townspeople gathered around the man. He had a long beard, chewed tobacco, snuff, was shy and talked very little. He shortly began fussing and cussing his cattle, got them all on their feet, and prepared to go. While he was stopped, the wheels and wagons settled deep into the soft earth. When they began to move, one dumb steer did not want to pull, so he flew back when his mate began to pull. The drover hit the steer with his long whip up near the air. The whip cracked like a pistol. The drover cursed. The steer bled and got against the yoke and began to pull. "Haul! Haul!" shouted the drover as he popped his whip several times, and the steer began to swing to the left. The front wheel began to move a little at the straining of oxen. Then, gee, gee, with more whip popping, and the oxen swung to the right. "Gee, get up!" And the wagon began to move. Oxen move very slowly, very, very slowly, but can outpull any horse or mule. In the early part of the century, roads were graded with a high crown so they would drain. For a long time, horse and mule power operated road equipment. I ran a grader pulled by eight mules. The driver sat on the front of the grader. Earth material was moved with a small slip scraper behind a pair of mules. Then loaded by a Fardmore scraper pulled by three or four animals. Then came the mule killing wheeler, a large scraper mounted on two wheels and utilizing an eccentric axle by which the scraper could be lowered to scoop up earth and then raised by a long lever to cause the scraper to be borne along on the wheels to the location where it was dumped. It was a mule killer. The old wheeler was hard on mules and hard on the driver. And Mr. Martin, who worked on a ranch for Mr. Roy Lowe near Fowlerton at Zella, told me that the huge water tanks in LaSalle and McMillan counties were built with cheap labor and mules. This is the way it was done. There were many cowhides because cattle that died in the long drought were skinned and the hides dried. A pair of mules hitched to one end of the hide was driven to the excavation area of the tank. The driver, a laborer, there piled earth upon the hide with a spade. Then he drove the mules atop the bend, where at the proper place he turned the mules in the opposite direction and let them roll the hide over the dirt, emptying the hide. He was then ready to go back for another load of dirt. This was a slow process, but some of the biggest earth water tanks in the South were so built. Wagons prior to 1917 had a tread width measurement of 60 inches, which means it was 60 inches from the center of one front wheel to the center of the other front wheel. The rear wheels were also spaced the same way. Ruts on black or clay roads were consequently 60 inches apart. Some of the roads were also cut up by the wheels of wagons. Sometimes the roads became very difficult for wagons. In 1917, my dad bought a Model T Ford car. Its tread width was 56 inches. That was the first year a 56-inch tread was used. Dad bought the car through Cameron Blair at Dilly, and it was shipped to Mr. Howell at Pearsall. I went with Mr. Cameron at Pearsall to drive the car to Dilly, 16 miles south. The old dirt road crossed the I&GN railroad tracks at Derby. There was a sharp turn to the right, then crossed the tracks, and then turned sharply to the left. Sand was deep and dry, and many wagons had the roadway cut up pretty badly. With the turns, the wheels not fitting the tracks, the rails to jump the wheels over, and a somewhat inexperienced driver, that poor old Model T got stuck in the sand bed. The engine was stopped for 10 or more minutes to cool the radiator. Then I could go up to the front, crank the engine, and go up 10 or 15 feet before cooling the radiator again. Within 30 or 40 minutes, I got out of the sand bed. After some experience was gained, we could make the 16 miles to Pearsall in less than 35 minutes. To go from Dilly to San Antonio, we usually ate lunch near Divine and finished the trip by 4:30 in the afternoon. It was 71 miles with a lot of sand, plus a stretch of gravel road about 10 miles. On that 10 miles of gravel, we were in many tires. We always expected to have from 1 to 3 or more flat tires on a trip. We carried patches and a tire pump. A man named Mr. Bush, who carried the mail on the route west of Dilly, discarded his buggy and horse about 1911 for a car called a Bush. When it rained, he sometimes loaded his mail in bags on a saddle horse because the car could not go to the muddy road. His next car was a Helpmobile, which would have done better except it had the clutch and an open flywheel under the car, which got full of mud, water, and would not work very well in sloppy weather. My last ride in a covered wagon was in January 1924. I had loaded everything in the covered wagon. The new were fresh out of the pasture, but they were well fed. Included in the furniture and merchandise in the wagon was a piano, an upright piano that was sitting in the back end of the wagon. Various household items were already placed in the wagon. I had a good spring seat mounted at the front. The brake lever was outside of the wagon sheet. I had to stick my foot outside the wagon sheet to throw on the brake when it was necessary. Early in the night before I was to leave Caddo, a cold, wet blizzard came driving in from the north. Nevertheless, when daylight broke that cold winter morning, I was pulling out of Caddo, Texas, heading for Denton, 135 miles east. Rain began to freeze on the wagon sheet, then changed to sleet. Sleet and snow was falling on the ground in some places. The first night out, I spent about 25 miles from Caddo, close to Lover's Retreat, a sort of park in Palo Pinto County. The ice got worse, and the ground began to freeze. The second night was spent at Nimbus. An old barn was in the lot where I set up camp, but the mule refused to stay in the barn out of the weather. I finally learned why. The inside of the barn was infested with fleas. At Mineral Wells, my trouble grew worse. I got on pavement at Mineral Wells, and it was iced over, and the mules could hardly walk because it was so slippery. Their iron shoes helped very little because they could not keep the footing secure. I was glad to pull into a wagon yard in Bradford the third night. There was shelter for the team, a big room with a fireplace, and ways to sleep. The next day I wished to go along with two more covered wagons that were headed in my direction, loaded with about three generations of the big family. They did not encourage joining my little outfit, but we stayed together until we crossed the bridge over the Trinity River in Fort Worth. There was ice yet on the pavement, and the bridge on the north side sloped down sharply to a lower level. The poor mules were afraid of slipping, and in spite of the brake, the wagon tried to push the mules. When the brake locked the rear wheel, the iron rim of the wheel slid on the ice, very much like a sled or a sleigh. 35 miles from Fort Worth to Denton and 3 miles beyond Denton to my destination. And it was mid-afternoon. One more night to camp out. I was beginning to tire of the trip. I was nearly out of mule feed, and none was to be found in the area where I spent the night. But the ice was melting. Both mules had scalded shoulders. They had done no work for a long time before this trip was started. The cold rain rained down behind the cars on the steaming shoulders of the mules and scalded great patches on both shoulders of both mules. The harness I used was leather all-wheel harness, with one exception. I had no leather hoods over the hames to keep out the rain. 1927 found me and my brother Bialwood at Thal Furious with two dump trucks hauling dry mixed concrete to the big mixer on the roadway where US 281 was being built through the deep sand of Brooks County. The loading plant was set up about 6 miles south of Thal Furious at a railroad switch. The sand was so dry on the road and loose, nearly every truck had to follow the tracks that led to the mixer and then drive up the ramp on top of the turntable. The trucks were turned around on the turntable so they could back to the mixer hopper without ruining the surface where the pavement was being laid. At this time, this present time, 1973, that section of road is still in use and in excellent condition. The road has been widened on both sides, but it's still a good road. Trucking in the oil field in 1919 and 20 required skills that no other era has produced. The trucks were built on heavy frames with wheels that had solid rubber on them for tires. In some cells, the mud was slick when wet. The old solid tires would spin and slip and slide with only a little shower of rain. Since trailers were used extensively, the problem of spinning wheels was worsened. We wrapped the drive wheels with a long chain of heavy material. These chains would now be called log chains, but we call them boomer chains or tow chains. After each drive wheel was wrapped with about 30 feet of half an inch or 5/8 inch chain and the ends secured, it was possible to move pretty good on slick surfaces, but because of much rain and hundreds of wagons and hard wheel trucks, many roads were cut up into loblolly and high centers. When the truck differential struck high center, one had to know how to get off. Digging with a shovel was not the best way. A chain tied into knots enough to make a great ball could be tied to the wheel that was spinning. And sometimes, with an axe, we cut a big, long chunk of heavy wood, either mesquite or oak, tie it to a wheel, and it would help it jump over the high center. We called it fogging. Then when the ball of chain struck the bottom of the left, or the truck would jump about a foot at the time until maybe 10 feet or 20 feet or even a quarter of a mile sometime, the high center would end. It was an ordinary thing for trucks to leave the designated county road seeking something better. The old wooden culverts were usually broken down. Then with the deep ruts and mud, they were sorry, sorry roads. When a new course was started, it usually was this way. A truck would leave the roadway, run over the barbed wire fence, then proceed across a ranch or pasture by the shortest course to a given destination. The trail left by the truck would be followed by other traffic until a well-defined road was developed. I was traveling such a road one night after midnight. The truck I was driving was a Wichita truck. The steering wheel was on the right side, the shifting lever in the center of the floorboard, and was shifted with the left hand. I had just shifted from fourth to third gear to cross a good-sized gully, and shots from three men whipped the air. "Sticking up! Sticking up!" Then a pistol shot near my right ear, and I lied, "You so-and-so sticking up!" My foot was on the clutch, but I stuck them up in a hurry, too. Two of the hijackers gathered on the left side of the truck and yelled, "Get out of that truck." I told them I had my foot on the clutch and the engine would die if I got out. The man on my right, standing on the running board, the truck had no cab or windshield, told one on the ground to shift the truck out of gear. Then they ordered me up. They three gathered on the left side of the truck, and I started around and walked in front of the lights. The lights were pressure-like gas lamps with a cylinder of gas and hoses from the gas cylinder that was attached to a running board at the side of the frame. The hose extended to the headlamps, provided gas for the lamps, and as long as they're working good, you can see far enough ahead to stay on the road. The hijackers ordered me away from the lights, and they gathered around me and searched me. They pulled off my cap. I had on a cap with ear flaps on it because it's kind of cold weather. And I had on lace boots over lace leg pants, old army style. They felt around in the top of my boots with their fingers, and they searched my pockets. They took my money, my cigarettes, my notebook, and I wasn't scared right at the moment. I didn't think I was. However, I had looked down on the left side, and it was enough reflected light that I could see a nickel-plated pistol of some size, I don't know what size was, possibly a 44, with a long barrel on it. And my ammo was pulled back, and the man holding it was jobbing me in the side with it. He'd job me, and I'd flinch to the other side, and the fellow on the other side of me would job me on the other side. The third man was standing in front of me. They must have been amateurs, because that's not the usual way for professionals to go about it. They, however, went through all my possessions I had on, personal possessions I had on me. I said, "Now I'm going to want to smoke after a while. Why don't you give me back my cigarettes?" And I stuck them back in my pocket. I said, "That notebook is not good for anybody except for me, and I sure do need it." And I stuck my notebook back in my pocket. but I had over $40 in cash and I didn't put any of that back in. When I arrived in Crystal Falls, that's about 12, 14 miles north of Breckenridge, Texas, I piled up on the seat in the truck and slept the rest of the night. But before I got to Crystal Falls, and after I'd been going about a mile from where I was hijacked, I had to stop the truck, lay down on the seat to rest. I had a reaction. I thought I wasn't scared, but when it fully dawned on me, being killed, I got pretty scared. I laid down in the truck seat for a while before I went on to Crystal Falls. I was seen by a man that was going home from work, lying up there, and he wanted to know why I was there on the truck seat, and I told him I'd been hijacked. But when I got up, about sunup, went in the restroom, everybody was talking about an old boy being hijacked back down the road toward Breckenridge. I asked the provider of the restroom if he had seen the man that had been hijacked. He said, "I'd feed him anything he wants." I said, "Well, I'm the guy that was hijacked." He said, "Well, you ought to get breakfast at some house." I ate breakfast, but later I met some on gang and got the money to come back to pay him for the breakfast, but he wouldn't have it. Then we finished our business in Crystal Falls, loaded up the trucks, went back to Breckenridge. It was raining, had been raining, looked like it was going to rain some more. That's the reason I was up there in the middle of the night. The boss wanted me to get some more material out of Crystal Falls before it got some more rain. During World War I, I was working on a little ranch, John McCallahan Ranch down Webb County, and the owner of the ranch was related to Mrs. Alley, the grandmother of Captain Alfred Alley, who was just recently resigned from Ranger Service, Texas Rangers. She told me some tales that would be of interest, maybe. Mr. Alley, her husband, was camped on Frio River. He had a big corral down there. He had a bunch of cowhands with him. They'd been working in that area. They had a whole big herd of horses in the corral. They were all sitting around camp at mealtime, and about five or six horsemen rode up. They just crossed the Frio River at Rock Crossing. They saw the horses in the corral beyond the camp, told Mr. Alley that they were trailing some horses. They'd trail them all day. Mr. Alley told him he had not seen any horses, any stray horses. They asked Mr. Alley if they might go and look at the horses he had in the corral. And Mr. Alley said, "No, those are my horses in the corral." Then the strangers insisted they wanted to go on to go look at those horses in the corral. At a signal from Mr. Alley, all the cowhands ran in the camp. Immediately got to their feet. Everybody drew their guns and told the men that they didn't want anybody inspecting their horses. The men discreetly moved away after studying about it for a moment and decided not to insist on seeing the horses in the corral. When they started to leave, Mr. Alley warned them not to go by those corrals, that he didn't have their horses and he didn't intend to have them inspecting his herd. Later he explained it, said that they might have been looking for some horses they could steal rather than looking for some horses that belonged to them. He didn't want them to see any of the horses. He didn't want them around his corrals. He wanted them to get away. And they got away when they saw that he was not going to allow any inspection of the horses. Mr. Alley owned a house about 8 miles west of Dilley. An uncle of mine, Richard Wood, lived later at Simmons City near Three Rivers, lived at that old Alley place back in 1910 and for some years later. Many nights I spent down there, and on a moonshiny night, moonlit night, it was easy to see bullet holes in the roof, and by moving your position you could see bullet holes in the walls. There were some weird tales told about the old place, some old fables about the old ranch house. Said that on certain nights, in full moon, that chains could be heard rattling around that house, and you could hear blood dripping. I slept there lots of times, and I never hear either one. But tale gets started, people are superstitious, and they get some funny ideas. There was a tale about some men that were murdered there one time, not by Alley, but by somebody else. And a pretty weird tale. There was a man dug well, and it was claimed by the tellers of the tale that about 8 men and 17 saddles were buried in that well. Well, that was a true tale. I never did learn. I never did dig for it. The well, never tried to locate it. The old house has burned since I was there. No one did locate it. But another tale was told me by Miss Alley, old grandmother of the old tribe rallies, was about like this. One time in her husband, old man Alfred, was coming through Pearsall. Pearsall was just a new town on the railroad that built there after the railroad came in. Stopped in a saloon, and there were men in there, a number of them. One of them was kind of a bully. While he was in there, there was a young man, had just barely old enough to begin shaving, but he wore two guns. It wasn't uncommon in those days. But he had two guns hung on him. And the bully that was in there thought that this young man was just a tenderfoot and a bluffer. So he ordered everybody up to the counter to drink with him. His young men walked up to the counter and ordered lemonade. The bullet told him, "We don't drink lemonade. We drink good whiskey here." The bully was going to make the young man drink some whiskey. The young man said he wouldn't do it. Now the bully pulled his gun and fired into the floor right close to the boy's feet. The boy jumped back. Mr. Alley, according to Mr. Alley's story, or Mill Alley's relation of the story, the boy jumped backwards about 5 feet. Both guns came out of the holster at the same time. He shot the light out and hung up in the ceiling. And he said in a very steady but sure voice, "Everybody stand right where you are. Don't move. If I hear any movement, I'll shoot at you." And Mr. Alley didn't think that it was a good idea to move, and nobody else moved as far as he knew. The young man, they heard him go out the door, and they heard his horse as he left there. But the boy didn't drink any of the man's whiskey. But he sure did stop the man from trying to make him drink it. That story was told by a lady that during World War I was up in latter years of life, and she lived to be an old lady. Miss Alley and another lady from Ensenada was called Granny Walker. I don't know to whom she was related, but they were together a lot, and they stayed down in that little ranch while I was working. I slept in the shed room. They had the other part of the house. So there wasn't a whole lot of house there. The ranch belonged to Sid Lindsay, just a small place, about 8 or 9,000 acres. But it joined that 52,000 acres of 252,000 acres of the Callahan Ranch. Tales have come to my attention and related to me by people who are long since dead and buried. But the Wallace Wood lived at Dilly, a man named Charlie Miller. And Wallace Wood, Charlie Miller, and their wives went down to Rock Crossing, and that's the same area where Mr. Alley had come in contact with the horse hunters. There was a report out in that country long years ago that there was buried treasure on that hill that near Rock Crossing on Fuller River. Wallace Wood, Charlie Miller, and a relative named Lowry. Well, their wives went down there, they were going to dig for that treasure. Lots of people did that. After they had unhitched their team, tied them, and were preparing their camp, it was after dark, they heard a team. A runaway wagon come from the direction of Rock Crossing. They were camped about 300 yards from the Rock Crossing on the river. Team had stopped. They found where the brush had been torn down to the wagon, and the tracks were all there, and the wagon tracks, the horse, the animal tracks, and all were there, and the brush was torn down to a certain spot, and the team stopped. But they didn't find the wagon, they didn't find the team. That was a weird tale. But they said that they first thought that would be a good place where that wagon stopped to dig for the lost treasure. And some of them wanted to dig there, and some of them wanted to go home and get away from there. It was such a weird thing to them. And the way it was told to me, they really believed that there was a team wagon went through that brush. But then they claimed they never did find any treasure, and they finally decided to leave and go back home and not have anything to do with that buried treasure. That was kind of a ghost story. They couldn't understand it. They never were able to understand it. Donovan's down at Ortiz Wells one time. There was a prominent rancher down there that I better not name. We got a herd of cattle down the highway, old highway, and those days it was not paved, it was just a dirt road. There was a car came down the road, and it was, the man driving began to toot the horn and try to get the cattle out of the way so he could pass through. And the man driving the cattle, he wasn't by himself, he had other cattle punchers with him. He began to move cattle out of the way, but the man didn't, that was driving the car didn't slow down for anything. He was bumping against the cattle, and he finally bumped against this cow owner's horse. And he got through the herd of cattle. By the time the man on the horse could get his gun out of his holster. But he threw down on him and fired, and the bullet hit the back of the car, and either splintered the bullet or splintered something on the car that hit the man on the back of the neck, near the back of the neck, and caused a pretty bad wound. The man was a native, or a citizen of England. He went on down to Encinal, and at Encinal he began to look for a law officer. There was only one law officer in town right at the moment, and he was a game warden, had no authority over such matters, but he proceeded to try to help the man get medical attention. And there was a little bit of a disturbance in diplomatic circles between the United States and England about the incident, but it finally blew over without any harm coming in particular. But it was a real interesting thing that happened. One of the biggest manhunts that was ever experienced down in that part of the world was when a man of Latin extraction killed a man of Anglo extraction. A great man hunt was organized, and Chubb Poole, who was Sheriff Cotulla, led the posse that hunted and searched the trail and finally apprehended the man who had shot the other one and brought him in to justice. It was a long gone out thing, and the hunted man's horse gave out on him, or he would probably made it across the Rio Grande into Mexico before he was apprehended. I became acquainted with a man at Caddo who was quite a rounder. For some reason, the ladies developed a great fondness for him wherever he went. He persuaded me one time when we were at Cisco that we had a good Oklahoma. He wanted to go see a girl he knew at the Ponca City. Well, we had money in our pockets, so we started out riding train on the cushions. And passenger train, that's what that means. We got up to Ponca City, and I got pretty tired of the whole situation because he was must have been having more fun than I was because he wanted to stay there 2 or 3 days. We finally drifted out of Ponca City and Blackwell, he knew some of Blackwell too. We finally got back down to Oklahoma City and we were running short of money. Old Jack on the watch Oklahoma City, and we went on down from Oklahoma City to Brenham, Texas. I thought I had an uncle living in Brenham, but it didn't turn out that way. He was already gone from Brenham. We thought we'd go to work at Brenham, but it didn't, there wasn't any work there. The town was beginning to go in a slump. But there was lots of cotton, bale of cotton in the gin yard. We had enough money buy 2 hamburgers, and we ate hamburgers for supper, and slept on a bale of cotton. Each one of us on a separate bale out that night in the gin yard. Next morning I was feeling pretty low. I never had been a tramp, and I wasn't wanting to learn. We went down near the railroad track. Each one had a suitcase. Another boy that was very knowledgeable about getting around the world sauce began a conversation with us and asked us if we had been to breakfast. No, we hadn't had any breakfast. He had a little money. He gave us some money and told us to go eat. But I'd like you boys to ride this train with me up to Walters, Oklahoma. Get work up there and we can get a job. Well, we ate breakfast and appreciated a lot because we were young and full of, had good appetites all the time. We climbed up in a gondola on the train with that boy. And he had a suitcase, too. He said, I've already made arrangements to ride this train. He said, I gave a straw hat to a bikie. Well, we rode that train as far as Frederick, Oklahoma. And we had to get on another freight train at Frederick, and we couldn't make any arrangements with the brakeman to ride that train. And he found us in gondola about to take off toward Walters. He said, boys, get off this train. I can't haul you on this train. Now I wanted to get off, and so did Jack. But that other man, now I just sit where you are. And we stayed. I let him talk me into staying on it. Train left out of there, and after about 2 or 3 hours travel on Saturday evening, the train stopped for water in Indiana, Oklahoma. Well, that breaky made a special point to see if we were still in that gondola. And sure enough, there we were. He climbed up, he had a club in his hand, he let you men gonna have to get off this train. I told you you couldn't ride this train. He said, I've got an order to on this train, and you can't ride this train. Well, we got off. I got off in a hurry. The other boys were a little reluctant about it, but I wasn't. I wanted to get off that train. But Indianola wasn't a very big town. We sat down at the depot for a while, and this boy we picked up in the morning said, let's go to town. We went up town, and he had a little bit of money left. We bought some canned goods and some crackers, and that's what we ate for supper on that Saturday night in Indianola. We went back to the depot to eat. While we were up the store buying the canned goods, we owned it in the little hotel, operated in American style. He said, let's go up to that hotel and spend the night. Well, they finally persuaded me we could spend the night up there. And we did. And the next morning, we got up, made breakfast there, and left our suitcases and went back to the depot to catch a train. We were going to catch a train and get out of that place. It was too small for us. We knew nothing there to do. Well, we sat down at that depot for hours. The only train that came through was going about 60 miles an hour. He was blowing his whistle every time, just as fast as just blowing the whistle there across it. I was getting a little desperate. This newfound friend of ours said, I'm going up to that hotel and borrow some money from that old man. I said, you stay away from that hotel. You have us in jail now. So, but Jack took his side and they started talking about going to that hotel and borrow some money. I was scared to death. I just didn't know how to do it. But wasn't much that could do. So he finally went up there and he came back and said, old man said for us to come on up there and eat lunch. Dinner's nearly ready. I said, oh, don't lie to me. I'm not going up there. I'm ashamed to face that man. He said, no, I'm telling you the truth. I said, you didn't go up there. You went up there to borrow money. He said, I've got money. He pulled out a $10 bill and showed it to me. I said, where'd you get that? He said, the old man lent it to me. I said, man, what kind of fella are you in here? We went up to the hotel and ate lunch. Landed on the hotel, also on the implement store. And he had lots of implements around him. Mostly grain planting and harvesting implements that he had because of grain and ranch country. Barney was talking to us after lunch. He suggested that those two men build him an implement shed, and there would be a man and a ranchman in there in the afternoon that needed some help out on the ranch. Well, he came in, and I was only one of the three that knew a thing about riding a horse, so he engaged me to go out and ride the line. He called it riding the line out there. We always call it riding the fence down in South Texas, but he called it riding the line, and the country was cut up into lines. Every section had a barbed wire fence around it, every mile, every square mile. It was good to get out of that little place and get out on the ranch and get on a horse, see a good horse. I mean, yeah, I had 17 horses I could ride. There was one there, but they didn't want me to ride. That was his. That belonged to the ranch owner. But he had three greyhounds. And I could take the greyhounds, the old man didn't move the ranch. Had a cook there. After those men and two boys finished building that shed, they came on out there to the ranch. And our newfound friend was in order to find something from the bin to give fresh pasture to a big bunch of sheep, was given the job of watching those sheep. We had a shepherd dog and didn't have to be in there, but sit out after you got them out in the pasture, sit there and watch them, see if they didn't scatter, and bring them in at night and put them back in the corral in the barn. And the dog did all the work. But that old boy went to sleep one day and the old man found him. And he fired him and run him off. But Jack stayed there till the harvest started. The old man liked Jack. The old man and his wife had some family trouble. Jack was quite a ladies' man, so the old man take Jack and they'd go to town somewhere over in another pretty good sized town. I know he'd go with them. But at that time, there were quite a number of Indians still in that country. And in the days they outgrind, and that was every day, including Sunday, out on the horse nearly every day. And then one more ride, I passed by my house. The Indians had some houses built by the government. And each family had some kind of a house. And some furniture in it, but they wouldn't use the furniture. They didn't know how to cook on a stove. They'd be on the fire outside. But under an arbor out close to this old house, there was a big old fat dog tied under that arbor. And every day when I passed by, I'd see that dog. And he'd get fatter. Every week he'd look a little bit bigger. One day the old man lived there stopped me. We'd visited together before, but he stopped me and told me in very, very poor broken English that he had a granddaughter who was to be married and invited me to the wedding. How foolish a boy can be is astounding, but I didn't go to the wedding. I don't know why I didn't go to the wedding, because it would have been an experience that I could have remembered the rest of my life. But I guess the reason I didn't go was on account of that dog. After the wedding, I never did see the dog anymore. They had a big feast over there, so I didn't get to eat any of their good old meat at that wedding. But I missed a wonderful opportunity to see some real first-hand Indian, and they were Comanches, I believe. They were in Comanche County. But I missed the wedding. But another funny thing happened. After the boy had been dismissed and left the place, left the ranch, I was still there and riding every day. The first thing in the morning, I'd open the gate out the corral, and the sheep would take off for the sheep pasture about a half mile away. And the shepherd dog, the sheep dog, would drive them and take care of them, drive them through the gate. I'd close the gate. Then I'd do the ride all day and repair fences, move cattle around where they need to be moved. One day, I well a couple miles from the ranch house, and I wasn't familiar with Oklahoma weather. I saw a pretty big dark cloud begin to form in the west, and I got to thinking, maybe that's going to be a storm. And I started in toward the ranch, and I was headed for that sheep pasture. I was afraid that those sheep would be caught out in a storm. And it happened that day that I was on the sawest horse in Bull Mule. He was a young horse, never had been trained much. The satellite riding must have not been very well taken care of, because it had a weak stirrup leather, or the lacing in stirrup leather. opened the gate, I yelled as loud as I could, and the dog came from the ranch house to me. And I opened the gate, and the sheep were all standing at the gate, all out and bleeding, wanting to get out through the barn, and I threw the gate open, and there was one old ewe tried to go the wrong direction. Well, don't try to change an old ewe of mine if she wants to leave a herd. That storm had already started, and the thunder and lightning was fierce. And every once in a while, lightning would hit a tree. And they were deafening when that lightning would strike that within a quarter of a mile of you. But more, all of the sheep got to the barn, except that old ewe, and I couldn't turn her. But I passed her up about two or three different times, then I'd stop the horse and try to turn her back to the flock. And all of a sudden, I stopped the horse right quickly, and the stirrup leather broke, and I almost fell off. And I thought, well, those ewe, if you want to go out on the horn, now go ahead. And I hung the stirrup up on the horn of the saddle and run down the barn, bit the sheep in, and pulled them up. Well, the next day, next morning, I turned them out. It had come an awful electric storm, and there were tree limbs knocked off. And the sight, you can see it riding along. You look around in different places and see limbs knocked off the trees in several different directions at one time, four, five, and one from one spot. And the lightning played around on those trees, and it was a terrific electrical storm, and rain hard. Next morning was hot and sultry. I put the sheep in the sheep pasture. Came in at noon, the cook said, there's a dead sheep out in the barn. Well, he'd been smothered by the, they all piled up there, and they were all damp, wet, and they went in there, and they all bunched up, and they smothered one sheep to death. I took the rope off my saddle, and put it around the sheep's neck, hung the other end on the horn, saddle, and drove right off down, get away from the house, and as I drifted along, I'd given about over a quarter of a mile from the house, and getting ready to turn untied, but shortly when I met an old Indian man in his squaw and a buggy, he stopped me. Hey! And I stopped and I said, yeah, what's wrong? You, what you do? I'm dragging this old sheep off. It's dead. It's smothered to death. What for? I said, well, he's dead. He's not any good. He's got, I have to drag him off, but I'm smelling. He said, you give him me. I said, no, he's not any good. He's been dead all night and all morning. I said, look at him. It's all swelled up. And climbed out of the buggy, he let me see. He got over there under that sheep and pulled a big knife out of his pocket or belt or somewhere. I don't know where he got it. It was a long blade. He ripped the belly open on that sheep and cut a place about 10 inches long. And of course, there's lots of foul air inside of it, so, and he pulled it right close to his nose and smelled like that. Me eat him. I said, no, you can't eat that. He said, all white man food, me eat him. You give him me. I said, yeah, you can have it. He took the roof off, threw the sheep and back in the buggy, got in, puffed to his horse to go, and he said, whoa! You, go to my house, eat. I said, you go home. I'm not going to go to your house and eat. I don't want any of that sheep. Some few weeks later, my mother and other members of my family were going to visit in Caddo, went up from Dilly to Caddo, and Model T. My kid brother, one of 12 years old, drove the car up there, about 360 miles. And thought nothing about it in those days. Kid 12 years old was supposed to be able to take care of himself. Everybody else in the party. Well, I was notified that they were going to be there, so I wanted to leave that ranch note to home and go back and see my mother down in Caddo. The old man on the ranch thought I was not being fair, but I had worked several weeks, many weeks, I don't know how many, and I made a hand. I always tried to make a hand. And finally, after he saw that I wouldn't be persuaded to stay, he gave me a piece of advice. He said, "Young man, I want to tell you something. You didn't ask for this, but I want to tell you anyhow. We were in his office at the ranch house. He said, I'm giving you money, and I'm giving you this advice. He said, Jack is not your kind of people. But you're not the kind of boy that Jack is. And I'm going to tell you this. Whenever you get back to Texas, don't ever try to contact Jack anymore. Don't ever make any effort to get contact with him because he could get you into trouble. Well, Jack asked me to send you his trunk from Cisco, and I did. I tied it up with a lot of good quarter-inch grass rope, paid the charges on it, and shipped it to him. I know there's no whether he got his trunk or not. Never have heard of him since. He was older than I, and I don't know whatever came of him. I won't give a last name. Then I could relate some more things about Jack. Enough, best thing to relate, I guess. But it was a very peculiar thing to a boy of my caliber to see our women with fawn over him. And the oil field of necessity is not far, necessity was between Breckenridge and Ranger, which was down the stream due to the oil boom on the railroad. The J. Cannon Railroad was built in about 1920. That went from Fort Worth by Dublin, crossed the TP at Ranger, and went on up Breckenridge. And I sat in the building. I rode on it. There was quite some building that railroad, because it seemed like it rained all the time. They were being built in the rain, the roadbed was rotten. But necessity, before the railroad came in, before the oil boom started there, necessity had a store and post office. And didn't have a post office first. It had a little post, little boxes on some posts, had a long board with boxes on it. Then they got to be too many people at necessity. They built a post office, opened a post office, and wanted a name for their community. They couldn't work it out satisfactorily, and the postal department said, it's a matter of great necessity that you give us a name to call your town. They wrote back and said, call it Necessity. Well, at Necessity, Jack and I happened to get together one night, one time when I was passing through there. And it's unbelievable how many women of ill repute were in that little old town. They worked in the restaurants. They had to have some kind of a visible means of support that the law would give them for vagrancy. And in the restaurant, Jack picked up the tab. The girl that waited on him cut the tab about half in two, cut the price about half in two, got to the cash register, and that girl that was running the cash register wanted to pick it up and throw it in the wastebasket. Jack still borrowed a hairpin from the cashier. There was no slot machine there, a nickel slot machine. We called them one-armed bandit. And Jack, and the glass in it where you could see the nickel go through when you dropped it in the slot, had a crack in it. And Jack borrowed a hairpin from the cashier, and he dropped the nickel in and caught it, stuck the hairpin through the crack in the glass, and when the nickel went down there, he caught the nickel and held the trigger down on that slot machine. And he stood there and pulled the lever on that thing till he robbed it of every nickel it had in it. He hit the jackpot and the nickels went all over the floor and everywhere. He picked up a half and a half full of nickels. Well, those girls working there didn't seem to mind. All they wanted was him to promise to come see them. And they didn't do anything. Well, that's, I can understand in part then why the old rancher up in Oklahoma told me that Jack wasn't my kind of people. I guess he and Jack must have been more of the same kind. I was working in Breckenridge, trucking oil field material. My boss wanted me to go to Dallas and pick up a truck that had been repaired up there. He said, ride the Pullman and go at night so you can work during the day. I got on with Jake Hammond at Breckenridge. I had to take him up a berth. No lower available. I told the porter before the train left out of, before I went to bed, that I wanted to wake me up when I got into Fort Worth so I'd catch the interurban to Dallas early the next morning. And I paid him right then, I paid the porter. And, yes, sir, boss, I sure do that. I woke up with daylight. Well, it was sun up. Wasn't much sunshine, but it was sun up. And once in a while, the sun break through. And I hunted up the porter. Then when you wake me up and we got in Fort Worth, I told you, you said you would. And I gave you a dollar. And I thought it was a lot of money then. For a tip. But boss, they were not in Fort Worth. But it was about 28 miles from Breckenridge to Ranger. And from Ranger to Fort Worth on that railroad was close to 100 miles. And we should have been in Fort Worth. I said, well, where are we? He said, well, boss, we're in Ranger. I said, what are we doing in Ranger? He said, oh, we had a wreck out on that road to the boxcar got caught right on the track and took nearly all night to get it off. Get out of the way so we could get this passenger train by. And I've been all night going 28 miles, laying up there sleeping. We enjoyed it, did it? But I was perturbed when I found out I was still 100 miles from Ranger. Well, the old J-Town Railroad's not there anymore. It was kind of a fussy thing when they went across the TP tracks. TP track, TP ATP Railroad wouldn't let him cross a Granger. But old Jake Hammond and the men working for him were old-timers at construction work. He got his big gang of men together. They had built the track right up to the TP tracks. And they waited until a train had passed by on the TP. They knew there wouldn't be another guy for a certain number of hours. They took over the telegraph office so that nothing could be done about it. He set his men to work and built the fog where they could cross the TP track without the TP's permission. And he proceeded on with that railroad to Breckenridge from Ranger. And it was kind of a stirring time because there were all kinds of threats, but nothing was ever done about it. But it was real interesting to watch those firemen and the rest of the train crews and how they'd come to an old oil rig that'd been abandoned, get out, gather up a lot of the old lumber out on their fuel car on the coal tender to use for fuel to fire the engine on that railroad when they first started. When the first passenger train came into Breckenridge, they were loaded. The passenger cars were loaded. The baggage cars were loaded with passengers. There were people with passengers all over the coal tender, all over the riding on top of all the cars, riding on the cow catcher on the front of the engine. They were riding anywhere where anybody could hang on, and some of them couldn't hang on just so long. They'd pull on and stand on the bottom step of the passenger car and just hold on to the handrail until they'd give out, and then they'd drop off and come along the side train for a little while, and they'd jump back on. And that's the way they came into town, blowing their whistle. Came into Breckenridge, and I would watch them come in. It was quite a stirring event. Another railroad was built in from Cisco to Ranger. It was called Cisco Northeastern. It was built into Ranger. Then it went on northeast to, they were built into Breckenridge, Cisco to Breckenridge. They went on into, across the Jake Hammond at Breckenridge. Didn't exactly cross it, but it crossed where it would have been if it had gone on through. And proceeded on to Graham. While at the same time, they were building from the Graham end, coming back toward Breckenridge. And at South Bend, they crossed the Brazos River, near Clear Fork of the Brazos River. Right where the river comes into the Salt Fork and the Clear Fork come together in South Bend. And they crossed the river there and built the bridge. Now I've watched them come in, watched them lay in rail, watched them driving piling going across that river. A real thrilling to watch a railroad coming into a land where there'd never been a railroad before. And it wasn't very fit to settle until the oil boom started. All of those things are gone now. There's not any more of that. And the old river, the Brazos River, and not very far below there, at the Possum Kingdom Dam, there's an enormous big lake, a beautiful place on the Brazos River. The Brazos River goes a long ways, and I've been on it in lots of places. One of the most scary places that I ever crossed it was north of Paula Pinkham on a swinging bridge. There was a bridge across it with a long bridge and it was old. And when oil was discovered on the north side of the Brazos River, I hauled oil field material sell big loads on truck across that old swinging bridge. Boy, they'd allow on the 12 cows around the bridge at one time for the freight to break it down. And the bridge would sway down so much that when you come out, when it sway down close to the water, it looked like you'd run right up a steep hill going up to the other end of the bridge. But finally, turned over enough, one truck fell off, or part fell off, and a whole load of material fell in the river. The truck itself was suspended, it was hung on the rails, and I made it fall clear off. But it was a scary thing to cross that old swinging bridge. That's been replaced now by a good modern concrete bridge. Down in LaSalle County, it rained 8 days and nights before there was any highway pavement down in LaSalle County. That was one of the last paved roads on Highway 81 that formerly was called Patnell Highway. Then it was State Highway number 2, then U.S. Highway 81. Now it's IH Highway 35. In those days, there was no pavement in LaSalle County. That was the last gap between Laredo and San Antonio to be paved. And in those 8 days, the highway gang, which I don't remember, stayed down there day and night, never had a change of clothes, having traffic through that mud. There was very little traffic moving north, but lots of traffic moving south. Mexico was repatriating a lot of their people from Chicago and Detroit and other industrial cities, and they were going, the cars were coming through by the hundreds, old jalopies. Anything in the world that had power and wheels that they could move with, and they were going south, going back to Mexico. But then occasionally it'd be people, natives, Texas, and maybe other states too, wanting to go down there. And we'd stay with them. We'd take a bunch through from Artesia Wells, go on through to the gravel road down at a switch about 12 miles south, and it'd take all day to move a big bunch of cars through. Then we'd try to get back home, back to Artesia Wells. By 1:30 or 2 o'clock, we'd pile up and sleep in those muddy clothes. Anywhere we could sleep until lighten up to work again. And then we'd move another bunch through. Ramsey Hendrickson and his wife had some little cabins at Artesia Wells, and there were lots of people trying to rent those cabins. But Ramsey wouldn't let anybody out of the cabins but the men that were working on the road. And he never did collect one nickel from us. He wouldn't even charge us for sleeping in his cabin. And his wife would change those sheets every other day, and we were sleeping in there with muddy clothes on. Wonderful people. His wife is not living any longer. Ramsey is not in good health, but he lives in Pearsall. A very noble fella. He wanted those living in to have the best that he had. And he provided us food when nobody else could get any. He had a ration in his store. And it was hard to get to Cotulla to get more supplies, but he'd get enough. He'd save back some for us, so when we get in after midnight, he'd give us something to eat and then give us breakfast. But it was a hard 8 days and 7 nights that we spent that mud. But now there's a good road going through there.